Kia ora, my name's Luke Good and this is the Policy Pod, brought to you by the Public Policy Institute at the University of Auckland. Today I'm talking to Miles Allen, who's Professor of Geosystem Science at the University of Oxford. He's Group Leader of the Climate Research Programme and of the Climate Dynamics Group at Oxford. He's contributed to reports published by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, including the most recent IPCC special report published in 2018 on the impacts of global warming of 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels. Miles is here at the University of Auckland as a distinguished visitor at the Public Policy Institute, and he's going to be delivering a public lecture on climate science as part of the university's 2019 Global Speaker Series. Professor Miles Allen, kia ora. Thank you for joining us. You're here in Aotearoa, New Zealand, to talk about the commitment to reaching net zero carbon emissions by 2050, which of course is now on the policy agenda both here and in other countries such as the UK, which is about commitment to maintaining global warming to within 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels. And can we begin perhaps by asking what, if any, are the specific challenges and opportunities, perhaps, for New Zealand in this respect? Obviously, we're a geographically remote country, a long way from export markets, have an economy heavily based on agriculture and dairy in particular, also heavily dependent on international tourism and thereby aviation and so on. So what are the particular features of the situation for New Zealand as far as you see it?
Well, New Zealand's got a great opportunity here. It's one of the first countries to actually try and enact a Zero Carbon Act, and so that you're ahead of the game, and that gives you both challenges and opportunities. You can make mistakes, but you can also lead the world and show the world how to do things. And that's why a lot of people in the academic community are quite excited about what New Zealand is doing here. The other really interesting thing about New Zealand is that although it's obviously a developed country, it's got an emission profile that's actually much more akin to many developing countries, many of the big developing country emitters, which have large agricultural sectors. And therefore, the way New Zealand designs a net zero carbon act for the agricultural sector in particular could provide a template for many other much bigger emitters. And one of the things you absolutely mustn't do is put people off. And so setting a good example of how effective climate policy can work, even with a large agricultural sector involved, I think is the big opportunity here, the big prize.
So can I ask you a little bit more about how we might put people off? What might we do wrong? What are some of the big risks of being an early mover in this field?
Well, the way the crucial question, which many people are worried about, is the way methane is treated in climate policy. In Europe, for example, we basically pretend methane is another kind of CO2, just a more powerful sort of CO2. And it isn't. And many farmers in Europe are aware of the fact that this may result in them being treated unfairly. It's important to note that unfairly doesn't always mean missing out. I mean, it can be unfair either way, and it's not clear whether farmers in Europe are losing out from current policies or gaining from current policies. But in Europe, it's not been a very high priority for the European Commission, because at the end of the day, agriculture is a relatively small part of the European economy as a whole, although, of course, it's a big player in certain countries like Ireland, for example. So what I would hope doesn't happen is New Zealand just sort of adopts European climate policy or the European approach to climate policy because it's there. You have an opportunity to do better than we've done in Europe, and in particular in the way you treat different types of gases fairly in terms of their impact on global temperature.
So just in very basic lay terms, the difference between CO2 and methane is, am I correct in saying that CO2 accumulates indefinitely in the
CO2, atmosphere? Carbon dioxide accumulates in the climate system. It's like lead in the bloodstream. It doesn't matter when you expose the climate to carbon dioxide emissions, they sit around essentially forever. So if you carbon dioxide emitted 200 years ago in the UK has ratcheted up global temperatures in the same way that carbon dioxide emitted last year in China has done. Ton for ton, it has the same impact. Methane is completely different. It has a lifetime in the atmosphere of only about 10 to 12 years. And so if you release methane into the atmosphere, It affects the climate over the next few decades. It has a small impact on the climate in the longer term, but much, much smaller than the sort of standard ways of equating it with CO2 would suggest. And so how you deal with CO2 and methane depends very much on what your priorities are. If you're only fussed about the climate over the next few decades, then sure, taking aggressive action on methane makes sense. But if you're concerned about the climate in the longer term, and most climate policy is focused on the longer term, that makes less sense.
So could a well-designed act provide good incentives for more sustainable modes of agriculture?
It absolutely could. And the important point about the design of the Act is that the politicians designing the New Zealand Zero Carbon Act have got many different things to take into account, not just the impact on global temperature. And it's very important to stress the kind of things I'm talking about in my lecture tomorrow and while I'm over here in New Zealand is introducing clarity into the Act on what the implications are for global temperature. The Paris Climate Agreement framed the objective of climate policy in terms of limiting warming to well below 2 degrees and pursuing efforts to 1.5 degrees. So it's all framed in terms of limiting the global temperature rise. So one of the things we can do is consider what the implications of the Act would be for global temperature, for the long-term impact, for this long-term temperature goal. And that's something that our work and work also involving University of Victoria Wellington, they've also been involved in this research, has helped clarify the different ways in which methane and CO2 contribute to long-term warming.
So just going down that track a bit further, I understand that the latest special report produced by the IPCC, which I believe you were involved in, made the scientific case, if I understand it correctly, for pushing strongly for 1.5 degrees as opposed to 2 degrees. And I wondered if you might be able to say something a bit more about why that threshold is so vital. What are the kinds of things that we might avert by keeping warming to 1.5 as opposed to 2 degrees?
Well, one of the first questions the report had to address was there a detectable difference even between 1.5 and 2 degrees? Because, you know, at the time the Paris Agreement was signed, there weren't actually that many scientific papers out looking at the impact of 1.5 degrees of warming. Most scientific papers had focused on much higher levels of warming. And one of the important findings we came up with was that there is very clearly a demonstrable difference in terms of risks of extreme weather and risks in particular for vulnerable and threatened systems between those two temperature levels. Coral reefs, for example, we expect very substantial loss of warm water corals at 1.5 degrees, but near extinction at 2 degrees. So it really is a choice between retaining the corals and losing them. That's a very stark example. Many other cases, it's a bit more nuanced. You know, you're seeing increasing risks of extreme weather events, which carry on increasing for every additional half a degree of warming. Those probably affect more people directly than coral reefs. Arguably, we all lose from the loss of the coral reefs, but if we don't get to go and see them, then it doesn't have such a personal impact on us. But extreme weather affects everybody.
So I want to ask you a bit more about the way that climate science works on future impacts of climate change in a moment. But before we do that, I wonder if we could just go back momentarily to the Zero Carbon Act, because we've talked a bit about the role of agriculture. Could you just say something briefly perhaps about, you know, where you think transportation and renewable energy and other sort of areas feature in the picture?
Well, the crucial finding, which came out of earlier IPCC reports again, but was reinforced in the 1.5 degrees report, is if you want to stop causing global warming, you've got to stop putting CO2 into the atmosphere. It's really, as far as carbon dioxide is concerned, the policy goal is really simple. You've just got to stop emissions. And that means for a country like New Zealand, it means any residual emissions from air travel, for example, for people coming to and from this country will have to be offset by removing CO2 from the atmosphere through some other process. A lot of people are talking about using forestry to offset the impact of aviation emissions. And in fact, if you take a flight, you can do that. It is important to recognize there's a limit to how much we can actually offset fossil fuel emissions with forestry, because you can't indefinitely turn fossil CO2 into forest CO2 and expect the whole thing to be stable. So in the end, we are probably going to have to end up actively taking carbon dioxide back out of the atmosphere to offset these residual emissions from things like aviation that are very hard to eliminate. We know how to do that already. There are companies out there that will take CO2 out of the atmosphere for you if you pay them enough. You know, the technology exists. It could be done, but it's not remotely close to being done at the kind of scale that we will need it to stabilize the climate.
Is there an inherent risk in putting too much, placing too much sort of optimism in the idea of technical fixes? I know a lot of people are concerned that that would be a very risky thing to stake too much on.
I sympathize with that view. But that said, if you say something doesn't work, you kind of let the industry in particular off the hook of developing it. So, you know, the industry is promising, the fossil fuel industry as a whole is promising that these technologies will work. Don't worry, it'll all be fine. We will be able to deploy these technologies. What I'm disappointed about is not enough people are actually demanding that they get on with it.
So one aspect of the carbon zero policy in this country is, I understand, the proposal to establish a climate commission that would sit independently from government, be able to advise, hold future governments to account, perhaps on behalf of future generations, at a sort of time frame that doesn't work with sort of electoral politics, for example. But perhaps also involved in actually setting targets or policy parameters and so on. And I think there's some disagreement around precisely what its role should be. I'm wondering how you see that. Do you see something that should be a largely advisory body, or is it a body that needs to have real political teeth?
Well, I can comment on the design of the political body. That's something which is definitely up to New Zealand. One thing I could say from the UK experience is that transparency is all important in this, that people have to understand why your climate change committee, as we call it in the UK, or climate change commission, as you might call it here, why are they making the recommendations they do? What's the justification of these different recommendations? So a key one, for example, is that, you know, this kind of There were three ideas put out last year. It was a very creative process, actually, that you actually put out to consultation some of the big questions on the Zero Carbon Act. Should it aim for just carbon dioxide on its own? Should it aim for carbon dioxide and then other gases being treated separately? Or should it aim for zero emissions of all gases? And, you know, there was a consultation with the public on which of these three options people were allowed to contribute to that. And in fact, as a group of academics, we actually contributed to that consultation. First of all, I think that was great that the government was making it that transparent and involving people in the decisions in that way. It also really highlighted some of the big fundamental questions here. If New Zealand goes for zero carbon dioxide on its own and just lets other gases do what they want, the other key gases being, of course, nitrous oxide and methane, then you could easily negate your carbon dioxide emissions are already quite low, your methane emissions are already quite high, your nitrous oxide emissions are high and rising. So, you know, you could easily negate any impact of reducing carbon dioxide emissions if you didn't do anything about the other gases. At the same time, though, if you went for the third option, zero in all gases, then that would be obviously potentially very problematic for New Zealand agriculture and potentially beyond what needs to be done to actually stop New Zealand contributing to global warming. Because crucially, because methane in particular is short-lived, you don't need to reduce methane emissions to zero to stop contributing to global warming. You just need them to be declining gently over time. And, you know, for that reason, sort of we certainly voted for the middle one, so to speak, as maybe separate treatment of carbon dioxide and nitrous oxide on the one hand as cumulative pollutants and short-lived pollutants like methane on the other. That would seem to me to be the logical way to design any Zero Carbon Act. And it's a conversation which I hope will continue because, I think New Zealand farmers have woken up to the fact that this is going to affect them. And they're obviously very keen for the Zero Carbon Act to be designed in a way that they see as fair on them. I don't think it necessarily means fair on them means leaving them alone. I mean, New Zealand farmers are contributing to this problem, and so they need to be part of it, but the rules need to be clear. And I think to get universal buy-in to a policy like this, which will affect everybody, everybody needs to understand why they're being treated in the way they're being treated. And that's this all-important transparency that I think is so important here. And one of the things I would criticize about the UK and Europe is we have so many really opaque rules that it's very easy for somebody to say, you know, climate policy is costing you X hundred pounds per year, and nobody really understands where the numbers come from. And so it's possible to spin a yarn around climate policy to say whatever you want. And that's a real problem. And so I think one thing New Zealand could do the world a service is show how you can design a transparent climate policy that any member of the public who wants to understand can understand.
Okay, that's great. And I want to pick that thread up as well, the question of buy-in and engagement with the public. I wonder if I could just sort of begin that part of the conversation, though, by asking you a very sort of, I guess, a very basic question about climate science and the role of climate science in the public debate. And I wonder if you could explain something about the nature of prediction and or uncertainty within climate science. For example, how confident can we be that if we pull a particular set of levers, we will achieve a 1.5 rise in temperatures? And then following on from that, if we do achieve a 1.5 degree rise, how confident can we be about the nature of the impacts of that rise? And I think I get a sense that, well, I certainly don't feel as a member of the public that I fully understand how climate science deals with those sorts of questions. And I wonder if there's a case for trying to get a better level of public understanding about climate science in relation to those things.
Well, addressing the first question first, which is the easy one, we can be very confident in what's going on, and that's largely because the answer is not driven by modelling or, the sort of complicated climate. I'm just going to start with that one again.
Yeah.
So taking the first question, which is the easy one first, there we actually can be very confident in our predictions because they're not really based on climate models at all, but they're based on simple geometry. The 1.5 degrees report made it clear that we are now at 1 degree of warming. So temperatures, global temperatures have reached 1 degree, and that's almost entirely human induced. And it's warming at 0.2 degrees per decade. So you don't have to be a mathematical genius to work out that that will take us to 1.5 degrees within 20 to 25 years. So we would expect to reach 1.5 degrees in the early 2040s at the rate we're going. And you also, it's not very complicated to realize that if we want to avoid going beyond 1.5 degrees, we haven't got long to reduce emissions to zero, to reduce that rate of warming to zero. Again, it's just a matter of the braking distance, if you like. You can think of future warming as braking distance in your car. You know, if the faster you're going, the longer it's going to take to stop. We're actually, temperatures are rising faster than they've ever risen before at the moment. So they're going up above 0.2 degrees per decade. We're going to have to hit the brakes pretty hard if we're going to stop within half a degree, which is what we're aiming to do if we want to limit the warming to 1.5 degrees. As I say, you don't need a complicated model of the dynamics of your car to work out that you've got to hit the brakes if you can see a hazard coming down the road. So on that score, I think we haven't done a great job as an academic community of communicating to people just how simple a lot of climate science is. Maybe that's the fault of academics. We love to say things are very complicated because it makes us sound clever and it makes, you know, us sound like we justify our existence. But actually, it's, you know, as far as global temperature is concerned, the challenge is really simple. We've got to get CO2 emissions to zero in the next few decades, you know, around mid-century, and we've got to stabilize the other drivers of climate change, get emissions of methane in particular and nitrous oxide under control as well. Now, what this means for impacts, which was your second question, that is a lot harder. I can't tell you about the impacts of climate change using geometry alone, because that, of course, depends on how global weather depends on how global temperatures are changing. And for that, you really do need to run these very complicated weather models in order to simulate what the weather will be like in temperatures that are, you know, substantially warmer than they are today. But one, I mean, advantage we have, it's a sort of sad advantage, but it is something that's happened, is we've actually observed now half a degree of warming over the period over which we've got pretty accurate information about global weather. So we've seen between the 1960s and around the turn of the century, so around 2000, half a degree of warming happened. And so we can look at extreme weather between these two periods, and we can look at the impacts of that weather between these two extreme periods, and we can see what implications that has for a further half degree of warming. And that's one of the basis of the fact that the 1.5 degree report made it very clear that we didn't just depend on models to say that every half a degree of warming matters. We could see it in the observations.
So in terms of public buy-in, I'm interested in your modeling initiative, which relies on distributed computing, ordinary members of the public, their computers being used to crunch numbers. And obviously, there's a functional thing there, which is about computing power. But I'm wondering, is that also a strategy of public buy-in? Is that a way of getting more people more interested and feeling like they actually have some, however small, some role to play, rather than just sitting passively waiting for policymakers and scientists to do everything on their behalf?
Well, I hope so. I mean, that's one of the reasons we ran that project, climateprediction.net. Anybody can join in. We mainly focus these days on understanding how our weather is changing. So it's not, it doesn't exactly do what it says on the can anymore. We used to use it for predicting changes in climate, but now it's more about understanding what those changes in climate mean for regional weather. And NIWA in New Zealand actually are big participants in this, actually, and we've actually had one of our longest standing collaborations has been with New Zealand, actually, on this project, understanding the implications of global warming for Australian and New Zealand weather. It's a great way of people getting involved and helping us to understand what's happening better, because we're interested not only in the fine detail of weather, but we're also interested in the unlikely events. 1,000-year weather events happen more often than you might think. This may sound a little bit strange, but the point is that we are affected by the weather in so many different ways that actually somewhere in the world, a 1,000-year weather event happens, you know, almost every year. Because, you know, it'll be just a different type of weather happening. And so understanding how the risks of these very low probability weather events are changing is absolutely essential to understanding what climate change is costing us. And New Zealand actually is a pioneer in this, in that New Zealand, just last year, your Treasury reported the first country in the world to actually quantify the impact of climate change on New Zealand's economy through various extreme weather events that have happened. And so NIWA, I think, did the work for the Treasury. They went back and they looked at the record. They worked out how much individual weather events had cost the economy. But then they went beyond that to say how much had human-induced climate change contributed to those weather events. Because it's very important, not every instance of extreme weather is actually an impact of climate change. Some of them, climate change may have contributed to it. Some of them may have made no difference at all. And so they included that factor as well, and therefore came up with numbers for the first time that any country has actually attempted this, of how much climate change was already costing the New Zealand economy. And that kind of hard data on what climate change is doing to us now and will be doing to us over the next few years is going to be absolutely all important in helping the public understand that this is not just something which may be happening to polar bears or might happen to our grandchildren. It's something that's happening to us now.
Do you have a view on discussions about the linguistic framing? So you're talking there about extreme weather events. So the phrase global warming doesn't necessarily convey that notion of extremity, including at both ends of the... There's people such as the environmental journalist George Monbiot, who's advocating that we stop talking about climate change and call it climate breakdown. Do you Do you and your community of scientists, you know, and IPCC work, is there any sort of significance given to the way that this is framed in language in order to sort of promote better public discourse and understanding about it? Or is that a matter more for the politicians and the opinion leaders?
Certainly IPCC wouldn't choose phrases because of a particular salience with a particular group, because of course the IPCC is a panel of scientists reporting to all the world's governments, including governments that may have a pretty dim view of phrases like climate breakdown. So no, the IPCC aims for clarity of language alone. We're not aiming for evocative language or to get a particular emotional response. I understand why journalists take a different view, and that's obviously their job, because, you know, their job is to get a response as well as to communicate. I think as scientists, we have to be really careful about getting involved in that emotional response beyond just communicating what's going on. Because I think what's going on, when you get it, it's pretty huge. And I think once people take on what's happening, you don't really have to dress it up in scary-sounding languages to get them to take it seriously.
So would part of that be the role of popular culture? I mean, sort of thinking back sort of over a decade when The Inconvenient Truth sort of gained traction in the popular imagination. There are occasional examples of science fiction, perhaps, that sort of portray futures that climate futures that might be, you know, reasonably plausible. But that in terms of motivating the public at large to engage with this topic, do you think there's an important role for popular culture that's informed by good science to actually tell tangible stories about what the world might look and feel like under conditions of climate change?
I think it's important for people to understand that. I'm not sure that many of the examples that have been put out recently are actually terribly good examples of that. But the danger with that is it reinforces the impression that, you know, climate change is something big and scary that will happen in the distant future and happen to us all. That's another issue. I mean, one of the things, I'm no psychologist, but sort of reading popular psychology like everybody else does, I understand that humans don't typically worry so much about things that happen to all of us. So if people see something as something that, you know, like people in California, the way they react to the risk of an earthquake, because they know the earthquake will affect everybody, it's somehow less high on their priorities than, you know, the risk of somebody building a house next door, which will devalue their house because of the interrupting the view. You know, that's something which affects you as an individual, and you feel that it unfairly affects you as an individual, whereas the earthquake, even though it might be from a sort of objective level much more unpleasant because it affects everybody and all your neighbors at the same time, then it's something that you are emotionally less troubled by. And I think this is one of the problems we have with climate change. It's very often presented, even by opinion formers who, with the best intentions, they think they're helping by emphasizing the fact that we're all in this together. One of the things I often find myself emphasizing to people is, actually, the impacts of climate change are going to be really, really unfair. Some people are going to be very adversely affected by climate change. You know, Spanish farmers are going to lose out potentially big time if they can't actually grow crops anymore because of changing rainfall and heat patterns. Australian farmers may well be losing out massively. Other people may not be that much affected. And these injustices are actually what are going to ultimately make the climate issue a very painful one to deal with over this century. People often ask me, are you worried about, you know, the Earth reaching 6 degrees or something? And when I think about it, I am less worried about the Earth as a whole reaching 6 degrees than the kind of conflicts that might break out when the Earth reaches 3 degrees and people realize how much worse it is for some people than others.
Okay, well, I want to end the conversation
On
a more hopeful note, perhaps. So just going back to New Zealand, I mean, I hope you don't wait 10 years to come back here, but supposing you come back here, you visit again in a decade's time, what would you hope to see well underway in this country on our transition to a carbon neutral future?
Well, New Zealand's got great resources, renewable energy resources, and the opportunity to decarbonize your transport system is definitely there. It will require, of course, electrification of transport, but that's happening worldwide quite rapidly, so you can capitalize on global trends there. It'll be really interesting to see what happens to New Zealand agriculture. It's essential that the Zero Carbon Act is designed to make sure that you appropriately discourage increases in methane, which would completely negate any progress on CO2. So that's really important. But at the same time, I think in order to keep buy-in from the entire population, it's important that methane is treated fairly in the Zero Carbon Act, which will mean, you know, not necessarily insisting that methane emissions go to zero, but that they maintain some kind of managed decline, which probably could be done by simply farming more efficiently. And, you know, methane emissions have been declining in New Zealand over the past, they're largely stable, declining in some sectors in methane, in New Zealand over the past 30 years. So, you know, if that gentle decline can be sustained, then that would be enough to put New Zealand well on a path to stopping contributing to global warming. And that would be quite an achievement. It could easily be the first nation to actually do that. And crucially, to show a way of doing that to other countries that is both, you know, fair on different sectors of society and transparent, which allows the public to see why they're being treated in the way they're being treated and what the benefits are to everybody through the process.
Professor Miles Allen, thanks so much.